Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Beyond the Divide. Today, we're going to tackle a topic that is hitting classrooms like a digital storm. Guys, our kids are getting slapped with cheating accusations because of faulty AI detectors. And if you are a parent who knows what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, imagine pouring your heart into a school essay only to have a teacher hit scan on some stupid glitchy software, and boom, just like that, you are labeled a cheater. Okay, we're talking false positives that are ruining grades, crushing confidence, and forcing students to dumb down their writing just to prove that they're human. So stick with me, guys. This one's gonna be great.
Rise above, we're breaking through. No more lines, just me and you. Hearts align, we'll find the way. Together, we'll seize the day. Beyond the divide, we'll stand as one. Chasing truth till the fight is won. From the shadows to the light, we strive. United, we thrive. Beyond the divide.
Okay, first off, I'm going to set the scene. AI detectors or tools like Turnitin or GPT-0 are popping up everywhere in schools. They're in high schools, they're in colleges, they're everywhere. Okay, and they're supposed to be able to sniff out if a kid copy-pasted from ChatGPT or if they wrote the work themselves. And in theory, this sounds really great, right? Catch the cheaters, keep things fair. But here's the sucker punch. These tools are riddled with errors, especially with false positives. There are false negatives, but they don't happen nearly as often as false positives. And that's when they flag like actual human work as AI generated. Okay, studies are showing that they are neither accurate nor reliable. And they're churning out rates of false positives at such high percentages that many of the creators are abandoning the software because they can't stand behind it. Even a tiny 0.1% error rate means that hundreds of innocent kids are getting wrongly accused when teachers are scanning thousands of papers. And it's not just numbers, okay? This can be lives on the line. You can have a college student who's going back to school. You know, maybe you have a mom that's going back to school after starting a family. She turns in a simple reading summary, okay? How easy is a reading summary? Turns it in, AI slaps it down, and it gets flagged. And her professor gives her a zero. No questions asked, no deeper look, just bam, grade tanked, just like that. Okay. This actually happened to a woman who attended the University of Houston, and she spent 2 days drafting a cover letter. She submitted it, it got flagged. She got a zero on 15% of her final grade because the tool said it was AI. So to fight back, she compiled a 15-page document of screenshots, timestamps, and notes that proved her process. So her grade got restored. But why should we have to fight to prove that our work is our own? Okay, authors since like the dawn of time, some authors have used things called ghostwriters. They've never had to prove their work. Everyone knows that it happens. Some authors give credit to their ghostwriters, others do not. Very well-known authors turn in work to publishers that is not even publishable and has to be completely rewritten. But it still gets done. Their book gets published. Millions of people around the world love their books. They buy them. They're very accomplished. Okay. But now all of a sudden we have this technology and our kids are getting the brunt of the rage against the technology. It's not rare. Okay, two-thirds of teachers are regularly plugging student work into these AI detectors, and they treat the results like they are gospel. Okay, one high schooler on X shared how their essay got flagged as a false positive, and they had to rewrite the entire thing in class while the teacher watched just to prove that it was real. Other students are at risk of outright failing a class because Turnitin flags their work as AI. Teachers, I get it. You are swamped, and these tools promise a quick fix for you. But when you skip the human review and you let the algorithm decide, you are not only missing the cheaters, you are punishing the honest, creative work. It's like committing fraud by presenting shaky software results as ironclad fact. And the truly heartbreaking thing of it all is that our kids are adapting. They're not cheating more, but they're figuring out how to go around the algorithm by watering down their work. Okay, AI spits out polished, complex prose. Think long sentences, fancy vocabulary, shiny, nice and pretty academic work, but it's dull and it's flat. And detectors love flagging it. Okay, so students are just simplifying. They're ditching the big words for everyday lingo. They're shortening their sentences. They're skipping the flair that makes their writing unique. Simple, chatty stuff that mimics the messiness of human life. Unpredictable phrasing, slang, and straight talk throws off the algorithms, and they know it. Students know it. Okay, picture a bright 10th grader that has a killer idea for an essay on the world's ever-changing weather. But the last time, their vivid descriptions got dinged as AI. So now they stick to basic sentences like, "The earth is hot, we need to fix it." This is safe from the scanner, but their voice is gone and their creativity is stifled. We are literally training a generation to write like robots to avoid robot accusations. And the fallout is crushed self-esteem, paranoia over every comma, every use of grammar, every use of precise language, every essay that they have to write, and the real learning stops. Our students are demoralized. A simple summary paragraph gets flagged, and suddenly they feel like homework is a trap, and they don't want to do it. This is like the absurd world that we're living in, guys, and it's not just unfair, it's counterproductive. These AI detectors are supposed to protect integrity, but all they're doing is eroding trust between teachers and students. And false accusations, they spark anxiety, they fuel resentment. And for what? This is a tool that even the creator admits is not foolproof, and they don't stand behind their creation. So, what is the fix for this? Do we make our kids explain their work at every turn? Or do we build assignments that scream human, personal reflections, projects that are tied to their lives that can only be human? Okay, educators learn more and lean on your expertise. Okay, get more training. Our schools are churning out kids at a 90% rate of kids who can actually read and write and do arithmetic. And they're just churning them out. So if you don't know precise language, grammar usage, spelling, learn it. Figure it out. Lean on the expertise that you were given as a teacher, not on an app that generates false positives. Okay, and this isn't about fearing the AI, it's about using it in a smart way. Our kids deserve better than a system that questions their humanity at every single turn. AI is the future. We all know this. And by knowing that, we should also understand that if we don't control the AI, it will control us. So, what do I mean by that? Just as in every technological age, we must learn to use the technology for our benefit. And that doesn't mean that we go to Grok or to ChatGPT or to Gemini and we say, here, write this email or do this narrative for me or create this PowerPoint. Okay, that means that we use the technology to the best of our advantage or it's going to control us. If you get lazy and complacent, the AI will be right there to take your place. Okay, let me give you an example. Last night, my husband and I were trying to find a song, and we could only think of one line in this song. So we're going through like tons of websites trying to find this song. We did the whole like hum the tune to Google thing, and nothing was working. So I decided to jump onto Grok and just ask. I was like, I'm trying to find this song with these lyrics. And within seconds, it's got a list for me of songs that contain those lyrics. AI has the incredible ability to search massive amounts of data within seconds, saving you hours and hours of research. But it also has the ability to write your emails, your presentations, your PowerPoints, and trust me, if you allow it to do that, it will replace you. But if we learn to harness the incredible abilities that are written into its code, then it can only be a benefit to us. We can learn so much from this technology, but we cannot allow it to chain us down. So, to students, I would say learn from the AI. Don't allow yourself to fall into the trap of this is so much easier. To just let it do it. Do not be lazy in your work. Put in the time and the effort, and then let AI support those efforts. Do not allow it to do the work for you, but utilize the amazing technology for learning. Okay, it's like when I was in high school, I had a math teacher, brilliant math teacher. But she used to drive me insane because she knew that there was a way to do everything on a calculator. But for the first 2 days of the week, we would be drilled into how to do it by hand. And we're talking like multi-step algebraic equations. So you've got like half a sheet of paper per problem to do it by hand. And so When she was finally satisfied that it was drilled into our heads and we could do it by hand accurately, then she would have a day that we got to use a calculator. And so we'd come into class, there'd be like a bright pink paper on the door. And anytime there's a bright pink paper on the door, that said it's a calculator day. So you set your books down at your desk, you walk over the wall, you get your calculator, you go sit down. And so then, after we have trudged through 2 days of learning how to do this by hand in long form, then we get to learn how to do it on a calculator. Okay, AI is the same thing. Let it supplement your work, but do the work first. Learn how to compose that email, learn how to do that PowerPoint, and then AI can help to supplement that. Okay, for teachers, I would tell you, your job is to teach children. That is what you are paid to do. You aren't paid to blindly trust the same technology that you are failing children for using, whether they're actually using it or not. The false positives and negatives are almost a 50-50 game. The percentages are all over the map. None of the detector websites can even agree on whether a piece has been AI generated or enhanced or if it's raw human work. And I actually did an experiment with this yesterday. I took a chapter from a Louis L'Amour novel. For those of you who don't know who he is, he was the foremost Western author of a generation. And he passed away long before the internet was even like a daily used thing. So I took this chapter and I plugged it into every single AI detector that I could find, and every single one of them called it out as being either AI generated or enhanced. And the percentages varied from 15 to 85%. That's how bad this tech is. Okay, a guy who wasn't even alive is being flagged in his work. And I can't even imagine if I were to use the works of J.R.R. Tolkien or C.S. Lewis. Like, I would probably break the detector. So do not allow yourselves to blindly trust the technology that is so clearly flawed. Be the human element. Be the teacher that takes a second look at a student's work. It is so easy to tell AI generated and enhanced work. Like, it's not even funny. It's dull, it's flat, it's extremely repetitive. Okay, don't force your students to give you mediocre work because you're not willing to do your job. Do not stifle the light and the creativity of this generation because the text says so. This is how creativity dies. This is how our students turn into a bunch of robots, and this is how AI takes over. Okay, as you can tell, guys, I am really fired up about this today. We are dealing with this in our home right now with our sophomore. And we made the decision about 5 years ago now to homeschool our kids, but we wanted our children to be able to have accredited high school diplomas. And so the children that are of high school age, they take classes online to be able to get an accredited diploma. And so our sophomore has an English class right now, and she is getting dinged right and left. Okay, she is so creative, and she has written and illustrated 6 children's books at this point. She knows how to use a thesaurus and a dictionary, and she's very precise in her language when it comes to her writing. Not so much her speaking or her texting, but her writing is polished. She's precise in her language, and her grammar is flawless, and she's getting dinged right and left. And so she took the hit on her latest piece of writing, and her teacher gave her 2 options. She could either reset the assignment and redo the piece, or She could have a Zoom meeting with the teacher and explain her writing process. And she's absolutely refusing to have to explain herself, which I don't blame her for. So she chose to rewrite the piece. And she sent it to me last night, and boy, did she ever get out her thesaurus. And she created the most hilarious, amazing piece of writing that is full of spitfire that I have ever read in my life. And I am positive that she's going to get flagged. And she's got me pretty fired up, but she won't let me talk to the teacher, which I also applaud her for. She's very strong, she's independent, she fights her own battles. And I don't know if she's going to win this fight, but she's fighting it. And she's not going to go down quietly. So to you, I say, fight on, my brave girl. Okay, guys, I want to switch gears here just a little bit. I need to have a come to Jesus moment. So you're going to have one with me. Okay? So let's switch gears here. Let's talk about trust and what the Bible says about trusting each other. The greatest example of trust in the Bible is Christ on the cross, putting his full and complete trust in God the Father, that the work was finished and that he would be received into his glory. Okay? Ultimate trust. And this is pretty powerful stuff, and we're going to get into that, but not today. So today, we're going to go to the story of David and Jonathan. And just a side note, if you have not had a chance to watch David on Amazon or whatever other platform it might be on, we watched it on Amazon. It was pretty great, so I encourage you to check it out. But I want you to close your eyes with me and go to an ancient kingdom in Israel. In the shadowed halls of King Saul's palace, where the air hung heavy with the scent of olive oil lamps and the echoes of distant battles, a bond was forged that would defy kings, kingdoms, and the very hand of fate. It was the time of Israel's turmoil when the giant Goliath had fallen to a shepherd boy's sling, and young David, slender, sun-bronzed, with eyes like the Judean hills at dawn, had risen from obscurity to the king's right hand. The people sang of him, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And Saul, the anointed one, felt the first crack in his crown. Jonathan, Saul's eldest son, was no stranger to glory. Tall as a cedar, with the bearing of a warrior born to rule, he had once led a daring raid against the Philistines, scaling cliffs with a single armor bearer and toppling their garrison like autumn leaves. Yet, when David entered the court, harp in hand, to soothe Saul's tormented spirit, Jonathan's heart stirred in a way that no battlefield ever could. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. The ancient scrolls whisper that Jonathan loved him as his own soul. It was more than admiration, it was a recognition. As if the Almighty had woven their fates into the same thread. One fateful evening, as the sun bled crimson over the hills of Gibeah, Jonathan approached David in the armory. Without a word, he stripped off his robe, the royal one embroidered with threads of gold and the scent of myrrh, and draped it over David's shoulders. Then came the tunic, the sword, the bow, and the girdle of the heir apparent. Take these, Jonathan said, his voice steady as the desert wind, for you are the one that the Lord has chosen. It was no mere gift, it was a covenant sealed in silence, a pledge that Jonathan would stand as shield and brother, even if it meant eclipsing his own throne. But shadows lengthened, and Saul's jealousy festered like a wound gone sour. Tormented by an evil spirit, he hurled his spear at David during a harp's melody. Twice missing the mark but shattering the fragile piece. David fled into the wilderness, a fugitive in his own land, hiding in caves where echoes mocked his fall. Whispers reached him. Saul sought his life. Driven mad by envy, desperate for truth, David returned under cover of night to Ramah, where the moon silvered the fields like a traitor's blade. There, in the barley harvest's hush, Jonathan met him, not as a prince, but as a conspirator. They stood beneath a great oak, the air thick with unspoken peril. "What have I done?" David pleaded, his voice cracking like dry earth. "What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" Jonathan, ever the loyal son, vowed to learn the king's heart. He proposed a test, a feast in Saul's honor where David's empty seat would reveal the truth. The banquet unfolded in Saul's tent, rich with roasted lamb and the clamor of courtiers. Jonathan sat at his father's side, his seat beside David's conspicuously bare. Feigned illness as the excuse. On the first day, Saul said nothing, his mood feigned jovial. But on the second, as the wine flowed and tempers sharpened, fury erupted. "Where is the son of Jesse?" Saul bellowed, spear in hand once more. Jonathan's excuse drew a torrent. "Let not the king be wroth. He is not clean." Saul's eyes blazed. "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, as long as the son of Jesse lives on the ground, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established." And with that the spear flew. Not at a shadow, but at his own blood. It sank into the wall inches from Jonathan's head, a thunderclap of betrayal. Dawn broke cold and clear as Jonathan slipped from the city, arrow and bow in hand, to the field of Ezel, a stone's throw from where outcasts gathered. Three arrows he shot, each a signal, the third, beyond the boy's reach, meant flight. Then came the code. "Go in peace," Jonathan called to the unsuspecting lad who retrieved them, "for we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord." David emerged from hiding, tears carving paths down his dust-streaked face. They fell into each other's arms, not as king to be and prince, but as souls entwined by heaven's design. "The Lord be between me and you," Jonathan whispered, "and between my seed and your seed forever." David vanished into the wild hills, pursued by Saul's hounds of war, but the covenant endured. Jonathan's love became legend, a beacon in the storm, proving that true brotherhood bows not to thrones or spears, but to the unyielding grip of trust. In the end, when Saul and Jonathan fell on Mount Gilboa, pierced by Philistine arrows, David mourned with a lament that rent the skies. "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. And in that grief, a kingdom was born, not of blood, but of unspeakable oath." So let's start with a simple truth, guys. God did not design us to do this life solo. From the Garden of Eden onward, relationships are woven into his plan, and trust is the glue that holds them all together. Okay, in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, the wise teacher writes that two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up, but pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So picture yourself hiking a steep trail and your foot slips. If you're alone, it's a long and lonely tumble to the bottom. But if you're with a trusted partner, they grab your hand, they steady you, and together you press on. That is God's vision for us. It's not as isolated islands, but as intertwined ropes. And the three strands spoken of in Ecclesiastes is you, me, and God. And together we build a bond that is unbreakable. Now there is a flip side to this. People let us down. Friends betray us. Families wound very deeply. And these are the wounds that have a very hard time healing. And the Bible is brutally real about these circumstances. Psalms reminds us that it's better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in the arm of man. But there is hope. because when our ultimate trust is in God, we can then trust others without fear. Proverbs chapter 3 lays it out perfectly. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. And this isn't about blind faith, it's about wise dependence on God. Okay, when we anchor in his unchanging character, we then free up space in our lives to believe the best in other people. Just think about Jesus. Crowds adored him one day. Okay, he's literally going into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. They're laying palm fronds on the ground in front of him to signify that they believed in him as their king, as their ruler, as their Messiah, as their savior. They loved him. 2 days later, they abandoned him. They were spitting at him. They were screaming for his murder. But he kept loving and he kept trusting the Father's plan. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. God trusts in us to follow him in faith. And there will be times when we're completely human and we don't want to trust anyone or anything. And even Jesus on the cross cried out, "If it be thy will, take this cup from me." We are not required to never ask why, but we are asked to have faith and to trust in the timing of the Lord. We are asked to endure to the end, and part of that is going through seasons of our lives that aren't comfortable. And sometimes we're going to feel alone, and sometimes we're going to be judged unfairly by our fellow men. And God will not withhold these times in our lives because they allow us to grow. Our faith and our trust in Him does not negate the fact that we have to go through the refiner's fire. God knows of the gifts that He has placed within us and those that are being reserved for just the right moment. For the world to be ready. We talked about spiritual gifts. God knows what those are. Trust in him and in his timing. This is seriously, it's a hard concept for me, guys. He has asked us to trust in him and to have faith that all will come full circle in the end. But the end is so very far away, and the waiting and the trusting and the growth is so hard sometimes. I imagine there will be a day that we will look back on a highlight reel of our lives and we will see just how much we changed and we grew and that our faith multiplied exponentially. Until then, I pray that we can all have trust in one another, that we can remain the human element that brings love and light and joy into this world. I pray that God will touch the hearts of those who control the system and in whose hands the final decision is made, so that our children can shine brightly and not have to feel like they have to hide their gifts and their talents or be less than themselves to please a broken system. I pray that our faith in people will not be proven to be misplaced, and I pray that our faith in God will multiply. The sun is rising, guys. Go out there and find the common thread. Go beyond the divide and heal the broken system. Only we can do it. Nobody's going to do it for us. Pray to have faith. Pray to know what you need to do to fix the system. Pray to have the words to touch other people's lives. And go out there and do the work. Have a great day, guys. Thank you so much for joining me.